The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie, look what
my guest today on Getting the Yes And is Seth Godin. Seth is the author of 18 books, including Tribes, Purple Cow, and What to Do When It's Your Turn. His most recent book, What Does It Sound Like When You Have to Change Your Mind, is an 800-page limited edition collection that weighed more than 17 pounds. Wow. He is the founder of Yoyodyne and Squidoo. His blog is one of the most popular blogs in the world, and he was recently inducted into the Direct Marketing Hall of Fame. Seth, I've been looking forward to this conversation. And in looking at much of your writing, there's an incredible overlap with regard to improvisational principles, which may or may not surprise you. And one of the lucky things about having my job is that I get to talk to all sorts of cool and smart people. And one of those people is the incredibly talented actor Alan Arkin. And I found an Alan Arkin quote that felt like a Seth Godin quote. Alan says, quote, "We're all tap dancing on a rubber raft, all in an attempt to control the universe of ours that refuses to be pigeonholed, to be understood, pinned down, categorized, or even named." So improvisation accepts these incongruities, failures, and changes. So rather than fighting them, we teach skills to use them dynamically as a way to create compelling and funny content. Does that connect with you?
Yeah, and I think it's worth taking a moment to differentiate between the true spirit of improvisation and the people who are trying to look like they're doing improv but are actually trying to get the raft to be steady by following every rule they can find.
Right.
And sometimes they look similar, but they never work out the same.
Yeah, there's a real interesting study by Carl Weick, professor at the University of Michigan, who studied the people working on aircraft carriers and how he really identified that they were operating improvisationally. Incredible study. They had to move and make changes in split seconds or people would die. But it really was sort of an improvised act that required an immense amount of discipline. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is the best improvisation feels a little bit effortless because of that. And what it's not is following every rule to, you know, the dotting the I and crossing the T.
Exactly. And what we're really looking for is enrollment. So Ben Zander and his wife Roz have talked about this, that the reason the aircraft carrier thing works is because there's a set of generally accepted rules, and then there are areas where everyone accepts the fact that they're not going to follow the rules. And if you can get enrollment with other people, you can move forward. So that's why brainstorming session with skeptics in it doesn't work. It's why when you have people different time frames, it's very hard for them to collaborate because they're not enrolled on the same journey. The way I think about it is almost everything has a metaphor in The Wizard of Oz, and it's in this case, it's Dorothy didn't have to force the Lion and the Tin Man to keep going with her. That it was a commitment; they were all going together, whatever that was going to involve. And it's so much easier to get to the Emerald City if you're not spending a third of your time reassuring other people that everything's going to be perfect.
Right. And you talk a lot about failure. And in your book, What Do You Do When It's Your Turn?, you talk about it in a very compelling way. You write, quote, "If you are not willing to imagine failure, you're unable to be free." That's a very provocative statement.
Right. You know, we're superstitious, some of us, and we think that if we pretend it's not possible, utter inanities like failure is not an option, then failure becomes not an option. But that's not the way it works. I mean, for 10 million years, people have been pretending they're going to live forever, and they don't.
Right.
And so one of the best ways to enjoy your life is to accept the fact that you're going to die. And one of the best ways to launch a new project is to embrace the fact that often it's not going to work. Now what do you do? Because you can't just protect against the downside. You have to say, well, it might not work. If it doesn't work, no one will see it, so we ought to be daring. And if we are daring, it's more likely to work, so why not?
I'm curious, in your own past, like, was there a point where you became comfortable with failure? Was this in your you know, business career, early business career? Was it in schooling before that? What got you to the place of sort of understanding that that was a thing to be played with and not something to sort of like try to hide away or be in fear of?
Well, I have two answers for this. The first answer is this is a really dangerous line of inquiry because it permits the listener to separate people who do improv from themselves. Mm-hmm. That if those people are special snowflakes or something bad happened to them when they were 5 years old or some combination thereof, you're off the hook.
Right.
And having studied lots of successful people as you have, mm-hmm. the only thing they seem to have in common is that they don't have a lot in common.
Yep.
So I'm not prepared to let people off the hook. In my case, I'm pretty sure it came with the fact that I failed so many times in my teens and early 20s that I couldn't help but notice it wasn't fatal. And that is one of the best sorts of experience that someone can have. It's not the experience of success, but the experience of failure and persisting through it, because then you realize it's all a big joke.
Yeah, and I have found that I learn far less from my successes than I do my failures.
Right.
That just seems to be true across the board, because experiencing, and this is a thing we talk about a lot. I have a 14-year-old and a 19-year-old, and, you know, they're digital natives. And, you know, we've talked before on this podcast about the people who sort of fight by text and don't have that sort of human-to-human interaction and what they're losing with regard to the learning opportunity of how to behave, you know, and how you know, what it's like to make someone else feel terrible and see that. And you don't when you're just texting.
It's true. And I'm in your camp, but I would point out that the richness and variety of interactions that are available to people now mm-hmm. is much, much greater.
Yep.
And so if you use it with right intent, the whole idea that if you're 17, you could, come out as gay mm-hmm. to people who don't know you in real life, and then you could do it to a different group that don't know you in real life. It would seem to me that that would make the third time when you do it to someone who does know you a little bit easier for you to navigate. And I could think of 100 examples of, you know, we're used to having audiences. Most people don't grow up having audiences.
Right.
And an audience is not a friend, and an audience is not a human. It's a different thing. But this medium we're now living with gives everyone a microphone, and the question is, what are they going to do with it?
Yeah, very, very true. You wrote this line, and I'd love to explore it a little bit. You wrote, quote, "The epic battle of our generation is between the status quo of mass and the never-ceasing tide of weird." What is important about weird?
The weird is what lives at the edges. Every bestseller is a surprise bestseller. Every killer joke is a surprise killer joke. Nobody knows anything. And when you try to lock in the status quo and just do what you did yesterday, then you have AT&T of 1960 and 1965 and 1970, which is, how do we keep the world from changing because we are winning? Hmm. And around the edges was ARPANET and the internet and MCI and fax machines and all that other stuff, none of which was pushed forward by AT&T, even though they knew how to do all of it. Because AT&T was in the status quo business, and the edge case people were looking to appeal to the weird and ride their way to the center. And so we can see this behavior in media, in politics, in business, in gender identity, in just about anything. That is what culture comes from. It always comes from the weird and moves sometimes really slowly to the center. what's happened in our lifetime is it's happening faster than ever before.
Hmm.
It now you can start something and see it get finished. You know, when I wrote about permission marketing, I started doing it in 1991. I wrote my book in 1998. When I started doing it, it was doubtful that everyone would even know what an email address was.
Mm-hmm.
And by 15 years later, not only did most of the people you and I know have an email address, but spam was an anathema and permission marketing was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a massive shift. I mean, Ben Franklin, it took him 50 years for the post office to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing been in the third that time. So you're going to see it's going to get faster and faster and faster, whatever it is that spreads, and it's going to be spread by people who appeal to the weird.
When I started Second City in 1988, and I remember when I would describe it to people, I said it was a lot like the Island of Misfit Toys, because there were all these sort of people who did come from the fringes, but who in engaging together in a community had an incredibly sort of viably commercial product. It was almost like they needed this sandbox. And it was really for everyone to come, you know, sort of watch. And Second City's been wildly successful for so many years. But to your point, I think the key to its success is that it has allowed for sort of fringe characters to have that specific megaphone.
That's right. And so, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies was the most popular show on TV, setting many records over the course of its run.
Hmm.
And it got canceled because it wasn't weird at all.
Mm-hmm.
That the people they wanted to reach were watching Star Trek, not the Beverly Hillbillies. Now, Star Trek ends up getting canceled because it didn't reach enough of a mass. But the point remains that Second City wasn't commercially successful compared to an inane NBC sitcom.
Totally.
For years and years and years. But inane NBC sitcoms didn't change the culture. You did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, and when we've forayed into television, you know, our biggest success, SCTV, was like the weirdest of those kinds of shows. But
yeah.
And you're Canadian, right?
No, honorary. I'm from Buffalo, but I grew up in Algonquin Park.
Close enough if you're in Buffalo, certainly. So you got to see that show probably when it first. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lot of love for that show in part because it was so out there at the time. And my wife is a comedy professor, and so she'll show her students, you know, Ernie Kovacs and, you know,
right.
All the sort of Jonathan Winters and then SCTV. And for them, it's like, oh, this is a lot like Adult Swim. I mean, it seems very common to them now, but it wasn't back then.
Exactly. And Adult Swim is soon going to be obsolete because something weirder will come along.
How do you stay weird? I mean, so you've had a lot of success in your career. And, you know, when you have that kind of success, it tends to move you into being a bit safer. Do you find that you have to set a kind of like jolt yourself or find ways to get yourself in an uncomfortable place to create?
Well, so there are places where I am hired to be safer.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone wants me to come give a speech to their conference or corporation, they would prefer if I gave the best speech I know how to give, which is a proven, tested one.
Right.
And so that's what I bring them.
Mm-hmm.
But I've written 7,000 blog posts and haven't repeated myself yet because someone's reading my blog to read something I haven't written yet.
Hmm.
If I want to do something that is a new entity, like the MBA, the workshop that we run, I intentionally set myself up to first be bored because there's nothing worse for my creativity than being stimulated by other things. If I'm bored, I have to entertain myself. How do I find a scary edge? And then the second thing is to not look for a map, but look for a compass. What is the change I'm trying to make? What's a new way to get there? That's my job.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea of not looking for a map, but a compass, because it puts the emphasis on the process. And, you know, for us, that's the magic, right? The 12-week process of creating a Second City show is all where it kind of comes together. And that is like we have a failure module in there, which is the late night improv set to kind of test stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
And then but we have some you know, there are some guidelines. We know we got to get this thing open in 12 weeks. But anything can kind of happen in that place. And, you know, you, again, I think it's very interesting the way you talk about human beings, you know, that, that this creativity isn't magic. I love this quote that you had. It turns out that getting less lazy, more brave, more clear about your fears, your work, and your mission are all easier than getting more talented. That is not about being more talented, right? So yeah. I think I pulled that from your blog. But yeah, that's it, right? I mean, like, if you do the work and you know, with some purpose, I think you're, you know, show up on time, little things like that, I think you might do okay.
Right. And for us, playing is more important than winning. It's an infinite game, as Jim Karsh would say.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is we can acknowledge that every once in a while there is a true off-the-charts genius who shows up. But it's not going to be you. And in the case of comedy, Steve Martin would be the first person to tell you he's not an off-the-charts genius. He just worked harder than any of his peers.
Yep.
And his autobiography is great at understanding that. That my guess, having never spent time with him, is he's probably not that funny in real life. He's only funny when he's working.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good enough. That's our work. That we can sign up for that.
I also found this an interesting quote because it involved, you're talking about picking teams and having cast Second City for like 25 years, which I did. I know a little something about that, but you wrote, quote, "Most of us can agree that picking a great team is one of the best ways to build a successful organization or project. The problem is that we're terrible at it." I know what you mean, and I think you're right, but can you explore that a little bit for the audience?
Well, new research just out of Yale last week that I read about in the Times, they studied how people responded to job interviews. And they set up intentionally backwards broken job interviews and, you know, tested frontwards and backwards. And basically what they found is that if you're really good and really lucky, the job interview will not sway you into hiring the wrong person. Hmm. But in general, if you have a job interview with someone, you will hire the wrong person. Because the things that we think are important in a team member don't become exposed in a job interview, nor do they become exposed in a resume.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, what we know from Moneyball is that scout reports were all wrong for 100 years of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
100 years, every scout was measuring the wrong thing. And this is not surprising when you think about it. What we need to do then is pick people based on how we've worked with them, not based on how they present. And so what I've done for years is I only hire people who I've worked with before, you know, give them a freelance project, do an event, and then you can discover if they're good at projects and events because you've done them with them before. But all the other clues that we rely on, from you know, their pheromones to their outfit to their handshake to whether they answer the what are your weaknesses question well, none of those things actually matter. Now, I'll give you one last thing from that story. So the narrator says that her friend showed up for a job interview, but because of traffic and stuff, she was almost half an hour late.
Mm.
And she got there and they because she was nervous, she got there half an hour early.
Mm.
And so she was nice and relaxed, and they called her right in. She said, oh, that's nice. And they do the interview, and they hire her. And after the interview's over, they say, we hired you because you were so not flustered. You were half an hour late, and you didn't seem to be freaking out at all. Well, this woman, her invite had told her to come later, so she wasn't late.
Mm.
But she didn't know she should be flustered. So this entire group of people had spent a lot of time weighing all the benefits and pros and cons and hired her for a reason that wasn't even true.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah. And again, I think this is where we lucked out at Second City because we get to know that the talent is normally trained in our system. So we've seen them in the classroom. We've got various, you know, sort of like side theaters where they're doing, you know, small black box type shows. So you by the time that someone is in the place to actually audition for you, you know them. And because weird is a commodity we traffic in. These are not people who are looking to impress in a traditional way, which then allows for that genius to come out. And it's different to your earlier point, and you mentioned this, like you can't tell. They're all different. Steve Carell looked and acted nothing like Chris Farley. The fact that they both became incredibly successful is rooted in, you know, the fact that they worked hard and they were trained very specifically in something. But it's there's not a magic quotient. It's right. Hard work. It's right place, right time. A lot of that stuff.
Exactly. And people hate to hear that.
I know that because magic, look, our brains crave these stories, right? And we love, especially in Americans love this idea of the lone creative wolf out there doing everything. And it's never, ever true. It's just never true. But I think we still desire the story in our brains.
And you know, but the other thing worth mentioning is, even though it may be possible for anyone to succeed at this sort of work, anyone won't. And it's not just for lack of effort. It's because they bring with it a set of rules and expectations and principles. And if they're not willing to vary those, then they're just not funny, or they're just not creative, or they just don't see the world in a useful way.
Hmm.
So you can't have your cake and eat it too. Part of what it means to be Steve Carell is the ability to act as if. And when you can act as if and give up that thing that you thought was right, to do the thing that you're sure isn't going to work, that's when you discover a new weakness.
Yeah, very, very true. So you sold one of your early businesses, Yoyodyne, to Yahoo, right, ages ago?
Yes.
And you worked there for a few years.
After. I was on the payroll.
Okay, you were on the payroll.
I'm not sure how much I worked there.
I got you. I'm sort of curious. Okay, so Yahoo has gone through a lot, right? And now sold off its core business to Verizon. So I'm just sort of curious from your vantage point, how do you look at that? Like, you were there, they bought your business for a whole bunch of money, and now this whole thing is like, who knows? And they've got a crazy name like Oath, I think, now that they announced as combining that and AOL.
I saw that it ended.
Mm-hmm.
In 2000.
Yep.
So here's the perpetual destruction machine of Silicon Valley. There are 3,000 people in an office building. Every single one of them owns stock options.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those people own 20,000 stock options. That means if the stock goes up $2, you make $40,000.
Right.
Now, you are one of the people who run the company. And you have a choice of doing something that's great for the users but weird. You have the choice of doing something that might not work. You have the choice of doing something that's bold, that's at the next generation. Or you can double down on what you did yesterday. And Wall Street tells you almost every time when you double down, the stock's going to go up. So the people who have to see those 3,000 folks every day tend to make the decision that Wall Street wants them to. And it does work until one day it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stuff that we were building and the stuff I saw them not do, the stuff I saw them turn down in prototype stage, those are the things that became Google and Facebook and Groupon and all the others. It was there. It's not like those things were new.
Mm-hmm.
We knew how to do it, but it's very difficult for a newly successful startup to say to its employees, stand by, we're building something important.
Yeah. Is that connected? And you've talked a lot about money and our sort of like people's misconception of the importance of money or unhealthy relationship to money. Does that enter into part of that equation?
Well, yeah. I mean, so up and down the hall at Yahoo are people who have whatever number of million you want in the bank. Let's say it's only $3 million. And they're making an extra $42,000 a week in stock options. How long should they work before they actually go do the thing that they are dreaming of doing?
Yeah.
Right? How much is enough? How long do you stay as part of this system? Is that really what you set to do? And it not having money screws up an enormous number of people for really good reasons. You don't have enough to eat. You don't have health care. You don't have a roof on your head. And it needs to be addressed and soon. But it also turns out that making a lot of money when you didn't expect it screws people up too.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're paying attention to the only thing that seems to be important according to the people they know, which is they just made a lot of money. How do they make more of it? And we end up looking at numbers and comparing the numbers to yesterday's numbers and to our neighbor's numbers, instead of saying, I only get to do this one time. What am I going to do now? And that's a really hard question to ask because it's not multiple choice and it doesn't have an obvious answer.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure if you've listened to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History.
I have.
Okay. So there's that episode that talks about your alma mater. You went to Stanford. And he takes them to task for accepting a $500 million donation from Phil Knight when they already have a $22 billion endowment. I'm just curious to get your hot take on that. Do you think that the incredibly smart people running Stanford might have a faulty perspective when it comes to money, or is this just the way the game is played?
Well, nonprofits are also victims of game theory, and they also are aware of that if they say, no, I'm not going to raise money anymore, that they will lose a piece of currency, no pun intended, that will hurt them in their ability to do other things.
Right.
And so we built it around that system. I think the part, when we talk about big college, you know, when they build a scoreboard at a university instead of building a library, mm-hmm. that gives me a stomachache. When college presidents talk about their sports team instead of their physics department, that gives two stomachaches.
Right.
And so there will always be a desire for really, really rich men to put their names on buildings. And, you know, on balance, I'd rather have the building have the money than the really rich guy. So I'm in favor of that. But I'm also in favor of a university that can afford it, letting far more people take their courses for free, or to build another variation of that school somewhere where it's truly needed. They can afford to do that. It's forward motion. They got where they are through forward motion, and I think they need to be more bold. I think that the reason we have nonprofits and the reason we treat them specially is because sometimes they fail. Hmm. And so if you're a nonprofit, I think you have to accept the obligation that you have to do things that might not work. Because if we knew the answer to the problem you were trying to solve, we would have solved it already. We're giving you this money so you can solve a problem in an interesting way that will benefit all of us. And too often, nonprofits forget to do that.
Yeah, that makes great sense. Okay, so we're coming to the end of our conversation, and we end the podcast always here with asking our guest for a yes-and story. So the core principle of improvisation is that you can't start a scene by saying no, and you can't continue a scene just by saying yes. You have to say yes-and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering in your life, and this is probably a softball question for you, knowing what you've gone through, but do you have a time in your past where you would have said no, but instead you said yes and it presented itself the kinds of opportunities that we've been talking about that you can take advantage of in the world?
1979, there's an ad in the college paper to be the general manager of this new student-run business on campus. So I apply, and I go for the interview, and then they call me back. And I walk into this little tiny room, and the person who started it 3 months earlier says, Seth, this is Steve. I'd never met Steve before. Mm-hmm. We couldn't decide between the two of you, so both of you are going to run this. Oh, and by the way, we're bankrupt, and here are the keys. And he left. And I looked at Steve, and I looked at the keys, and I looked at Steve, and everything in me said no.
Right.
There's nothing about this that makes any sense. Promises were already broken. I didn't sign up to get paid $50 a week to run a bankrupt little project.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at Steve and I said, yeah, let's do this. And here are the three things we can do. And Steve said, three? We need to do seven. And then we were off to the races. And it changed my life.
That's great. Seth Godin, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for doing this work. It really matters.